Hi there, this is Martin Willis with Seaboard Appraisals and Estate Sales, and I hope you enjoy this free podcast. Okay, I'm on the line with Tony Dow in California. How are you doing, Tony?
Hey, I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing well, and thanks so much for joining us for the podcast today. A lot of people remember you from WALL-E way back when, and I was certainly a huge fan of the show, Leave It to Beaver. What I wanted to do is ask you, how did you get into the business of acting?
Well, it was an accident, actually. I mean, I was a swimmer and a diver, and the pool that I worked out at, the lifeguard there was an actor, and I don't know, we kind of looked alike, and, you know, we fooled around. You know, I was, I think, 10 or 11 at the time, and then he had a part, he was going out on an interview for a part that had a father and son. And as we know, anything you can do that creates attention in Hollywood is good. So he thought, well, maybe I'll ask Tony if he'll go in with me. And then it's like a father-son package and et cetera, et cetera. So I did, and I ended up getting the part, and he didn't. And it was a pilot for Screen Gems, which was a terrific idea, but just it was ahead of its time. It was a color show in 1956, I guess, and so that didn't work. And then we were going to move, and the agent that I had acquired through this previous experience said, "Well, let's just go on a couple more interviews." So I went on a couple more interviews, and Leave It to Beaver happened to be one of them.
Yeah, and you got the part just like that.
Yeah, they'd already done a pilot, so they'd already looked at, like, I don't know, 5,000 kids. So they'd already cast Jerry, and the network liked the show, but they didn't like the actor that was playing WALL-E, and they didn't like the actor that was playing the father. So they recast both those parts. So actually, I was lucky because, you know, I was on a short list. I hadn't seen anybody about it. And I also had the guy who was the executive producer on this Johnny Wildlife pilot that I was mentioning. he was the executive producer assigned to Leave It to Beaver. And so he said, "Hey, I work with this kid that you may want to look at." So I had a little bit of a help getting in, and it was just amazing.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, we'll talk about your sculpture in a few minutes, but I just want, you know, what was your childhood like? I mean, it must have been just amazing.
Well, it was different.
Yeah.
That's for sure. You know, I mean, I didn't know what to, you know, I mean, I don't know what to expect from a childhood except what I had. So,
right.
You know, I mean, there was a lot of work involved. We shot 3 days and rehearsed for 2 days, so it took a week to do an episode. And I had to do 3 hours of school per day, and then I had homework, and then I had to learn my lines. And it was a pretty full day. But it was interesting because of so many experiences and so many people that I got to meet, and it was interesting. I mean,
oh, I bet. Yeah, you know, my sister had a major crush on you. I remember that.
Oh, did she? Was
yeah.
she cute?
She was very cute. Yeah, I'm
well,
sure that was
where,
a lot.
Where was she?
I think she was. If you had a fan club, she was. She joined it, I'm sure. One other question I have for you. You know, I looked at your IMDb, your internet. Movie database, and you really have done a ton of things besides Leave It to Beaver. Was it really tough to try to break a typecast, or can you break a typecast when you're in a show like that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I think it's really tough because even guys like, I mean, the only person that I remember that really was able to do that, and he was an adult, was Kel Connor, you know, from All in the Family.
Yep, right.
You know, he went on to do, I think, a detective show or something like that. But even people like Henry Winkler, you know, I mean, he's a sensational actor. You know, he's sort of pigeonholed into the Fonz.
Right.
So I don't know. You know, I mean, I did a lot of other work, but it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a perception of who you are and what you're supposed to, you know, what kind of person you are, and so that to typecast away from that. And the WALL-E character, as great of a character as he was, he wasn't the most interesting character. So, you know, getting interesting roles was not easy to do.
I posted that you were going to be up on an interview, and a listener sent a question, whatever happened to Eddie Haskell? Now, I forget the actor's name. But I thought I had heard something many years ago that he was had something to do with the police department or somewhere or something like that.
Yeah, he was an LAPD guy, and he rode a motorcycle. And I can't imagine him driving up on a motorcycle with his dark glasses and his helmet and all that stuff and asking for your... asking for your license, but he got shot in some sort of a weird thing where he was chasing a guy who had robbed something or done something, and as he ran around the corner, the guy was standing there waiting for him. The guy shot him like
really?
Three times, but he actually hit him in his bulletproof vest and his belt buckle, which saved his
life. Jeez.
That was a tough thing to experience. And then shortly thereafter, we got back together and we did a new show called we did a movie of the week called Still the Beaver.
Right. In 1987, I think it was, or something like that.
It was a lot earlier than that, but, you know. Then we did a new series called The New Leave It to Beaver. So he was back working as an actor. So he's fine. He's a real character. You know, I see him a couple times a year.
And what about Beaver, Jerry Mathers?
I see him, you know, roughly the same. We don't, there'll be an appearance or somebody will want us to show up somewhere to you know, do something, and we'll do that. But socially, I don't think we hang out much together. Mm-hmm. I know that Frank and Ken, Frank is Frank Bank, who played Lumpy. They kind of hang out together, so I can always keep track of how one is by the other one.
Yeah, how about that? Well, okay, so let's talk about your art. Did you always have an appreciation for art?
Well, I came from this sort of, you know, creative family. My mom was very creative, she had a business where she did arrangements, gourd arrangements, you know, for centerpieces, and sent them back to Bloomingdale's in New York. And my dad was a designer, a building designer, and a contractor. So, you know, they were both reasonably creative. I wasn't much into art until when I was on the show. I started drawing, and, you know, and there's always a lot of talented people on a set, so I started dabbling, and I found that actually my strong suit wasn't drawing or painting. It tended to be assemblage, which is, you know, sort of an abstract form of putting things together, usually on a flat surface, on a wall or whatever. But So I did a lot of that, and then, but then it was after the show, when I was in my, you know, 19, 20, 21, somewhere in there, I started creating pieces of sculpture, but I used copper, and I brazed things together, and I did a lot of, a lot of sort of figurative stuff, and I did a lot of kind of interesting things. Like, I created a big coffee table that had a little train going around it, and it had like about 40 Western town kind of structures on it that were made out of copper. And so I enjoyed that. But what happened was, I got, when I was doing the art show circuit, where, you know, like the Del Mar or the Laguna or Westwood art shows, I would sell out of my $20 items, and had much more trouble selling the more expensive items. And I realized that I didn't want to be the king of weed pots in these going in these art shows. So it was frustrating. So I kind of quit doing that. I had always planned on coming back to try to work in sculpture when I retired, because I was busy, you know, throughout that period. I was, after the new show started, and then I started directing, and I directed for 15, 16 years.
Oh, that's
like
right.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, So, you know, my intent was always to, when I retired, I would retire by the seashore with a nice gallery and living quarters upstairs, you know, that whole idealistic artist thing. And that never happened, and I retired a little earlier than I had planned from the directing field. So that's kind of, you know, how it evolved. I started doing things, and I had about 20 or 25 pieces that kind of all went with this one series. And then I started going to the foundry and having molds made and having them cast in bronze. And, you know, one thing led to another. And so, you know, here we are.
Yep. Now, do you have any of your early work at all? Did you hang on to any of that?
I think I may have the very first thing that I ever brazed together, which was it was a really simplistic couple of buildings with a sun above it. You know, it was just, and I think I probably did that when I was 18, maybe, or 19. And then I lived on a boat for a number of years, and I did a, you know, not a model replica, but I did a version of my boat when I was probably, you know, early 20s or something like that. And then I have one piece that I did that's a real interesting piece. It's this old woman who's sitting kind of waiting to die, and in front of her she has a patchwork quilt laid out, which is also made out of copper and zinc plates. And another artist friend of mine and I collaborated on it. And the zinc plates tell the whole story of her life from her birth through, you know, through adolescence, through her first marriage, through et cetera, all the way over to where she is waiting to, she's recalling her whole life and waiting to die. So that I did in my early 20s.
Now, when you say zinc plates, is that something that's actually etched in?
Yeah, they were acid etched, and then they were mounted on the figure. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now you work. I see you work a lot with burl, which is, you know, my favorite, or one of my favorite types of wood, which is just so beautiful. The, you know, burl wood is basically like a tumor in a tree, basically. And,
yeah. Now you know it's a little misleading from my standpoint because I actually don't use the real burl wood. What I use is I use whatever the space between the trunk of a tree and the roots. There's a big ball there that, you know, that has a real interesting shape, and it has the same beautiful wood that burl wood has. The reason I call it burl wood is somebody once told me what the real name of this is, and I'd never heard of it, and I assume nobody else would have ever heard of it. So
yeah.
I just sort of simplified it down to burl wood, but it's that, you know, that space that's real knotty and clunky and really hard.
Mm. Now, I've worked with the other type of burl before myself. I've done some woodworking, and I know that when you're trying to do any type of carving, it kind of tells you where you're going to go. It's like you know, it's fine if you cut burl with a saw, but if you're actually trying to carve it, it's extremely tricky to work in. So I was impressed right away with your work. And before I forget, I want the listener to know they can see your site. It's TonyDowSculpture.com. So
right.
Tell me about working with the root wood or whatever it is that you're working with. What's it like?
I have the same experience sort of you do, that the wood kind of leads you in different directions. But I don't carve it. I use saws. I have a big bandsaw that I kind of do major chunks with. And then I have a number of different kind of grinders that, you know, some are like chainsaws, and some of them are just real heavy carbide grinders. So what happens is I'm able to take out any part I want, but when I start out, I'll start out usually either with a sander, a chisel, and a hammer many times, and just trying to define the pieces of the parts of the wood that I really like, and it kind of leads me in a direction. And then usually after about 5 hours or so, I'll find what I want to really do with it, and then I'll spend, you know, 15 hours or 20 hours or whatever refining it with the grinders and the sanders and the various and sundry things like that. And you notice my pieces all have a similar format. They have kind of small heads, and then they're mounted on a kind of a long pedestal type thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some of that that has to be done. But the wood is fascinating. I mean, many times I'll have something in mind before I start, you know, and then I'll just look for a piece of wood that I think will lend itself to that. It kind of works both ways. Either the wood will direct me or I'll direct the wood. And then eventually, obviously, I have to take over the lead and finish the piece.
I spoke with an artist one time that worked with Diebenkorn, and the artist, famous abstract artist, and he said that he never had any idea what he was going to do when he started. I thought that was fascinating. And it just reminds me of reading the Michelangelo's Agony, The Agony and the Ecstasy, about where he would, like, sometimes a marble would lead him where he was going to sculpt, or he actually pictured something inside of a block of marble, which is all fascinating. And I watched a video. We're going to have a video posted of you under this podcast. That's on YouTube, where you explain your art. And you mentioned that you really enjoy nature, and so a lot of your work has something to do with nature. Can you explain a little more about that?
Well, I think the wood pretty much lends itself to organic kinds of application. So, I really have an appreciation for the wood and the beauty of it, et cetera, et cetera. But my the pieces tend to be kind of figurative, and they're kind of hard to explain, but, they're figurative, and usually they deal with either a relationship between a couple of figures or a group of figures, in some cases, a figure in some inanimate object, and they tend to evolve from the natural, progression of things. I tend to think that I work with shape and texture, and then contrast. So those are kind of the three things that I deal with, and certainly composition and shape being the thing that gets me started to begin with, and then I deal with the texture and the contrast at a later date. But it's hard to when you try to really analyze what an artist does or how they work. Everybody kind of works differently, and everybody kind of also works differently for different projects. Mm-hmm. I've got a fairly large project that I did out of sculpture foam. And then I have this, it's the only thing I learned at UCLA when I was taking art at UCLA that I've been able to use. And it, I'll get the sculpture foam roughed out, and then I'll take white glue, like Wilhol glue or whatever, and cover it with the glue, and then put sand in the glue so that the sand, and do that a couple of times. And what you end up with, this real hard surface that it's got a real texture to it. And then I go back and I use fix-all or some sort of plaster material to then do the final shape and the final details and stuff like that. So that's another process that that I use. That's if I know exactly what I'm going to be doing, and or if I have a commission and somebody wants something a particular way, or so there are different ways to approach things. And I also never like to do the same thing twice, really. So I like to experiment with how things are approached. Some of the things I like to create elements and then combine them. Other things I like to just strictly take away the part that I don't like and end up with the figure that I have envisioned. So it's a real personal, individual process of how you attack something. If you have a formula, in other words, I have a series of things which I think they're on the website, at the end of the website, they're called artifacts. And
yes.
These are pieces that, you know, I envisioned from the beginning. It took a couple of years to sort of gestate and figure out what I wanted to do. And, you know, those are a process. In other words, I'll do like five or six at a time, and I'll do each one, the beginning shape, and then I'll do the plaster next, and then I'll do, and they tend to be, again, the term contrast kind of applies there, because they have a lot of computer chips and sort of interesting modern kinds of things. Not sure what they are in most cases. And then it's in this real organic kind of a tower thing, so it looks like it could have been at the bottom of the ocean for 1,000 years, or it looks like maybe it's something that will be at the bottom of the ocean in 1,000 years, you know. So that kind of thing actually is makes life easier if you have a process and a procedure, because you can actually get things done in a timely fashion, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you said you worked with this foam, does that mean you're making like monumental, like large pieces?
Well, the first time I use a foam, it's about a 5 foot tall mm-hmm. figure, yeah. And then I'm working on this commission for the International Swimming and Diving Hall of Fame, and so I did. That's one of the elements of that. Was made out of foam. Although, you know, this is what happens. You work a month or 6 weeks on it, and then all of a sudden it's not working anymore, you know. So now I got to go back to square one, because I'm happy with the figure, but it doesn't have enough motion, and it doesn't have, really isn't what I want for this piece. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a lot of time spent.
Now, what do you do in a situation like that? Is this something you absolutely destroy, or is this something you just tuck away somewhere?
Tuck away.
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, I have an idea for this particular piece that I may alter it and change it. So, you know, I'll do that first, and if it doesn't work at that point, then I'll probably either tuck it away and you know, I can cut it up into pieces and use parts of it for elements of something else.
You just said that you do commissions, and so do you get a number of them? A lot of artists say that commissions are really difficult to do. How do you feel about doing them?
Yeah, I know. I find them difficult to do. you know, one of the things that I do is my editions of my pieces. There's 9 in each edition, so the bronze pieces that started out as the wood pieces, there's a mold made, and the whole Lost Wax process is used.
A lot of people may want to understand exactly what the Lost Wax process is. Can you just go into that a little bit?
Sure. In other words, you have an object, and it can be made out of wood, it can be made out of clay, or it can be made out of whatever you want. And there's a rubber mold that's made. And it's made in 2 halves so that it can be screwed apart and taken apart. They take it apart. They take the original piece out. Then they screw the thing back together. So now you have a negative of the piece that you want to end up with eventually. And then they'll fill that with wax. And then they'll unscrew that, remove the wax, and then take the wax and dip it in a slurry, like a plaster kind of a thing, where they just dip it maybe a dozen times or however long it takes to get the thickness that they want. And then they'll put it in an oven at 1,800 degrees and melt the wax, so the wax will disappear. And now you have a cast of a negative of what you want, and then you can fill it with whatever you want, whether it's steel or aluminum or bronze or whatever. And then once that's poured and cooled, you break the plaster away, and you've got your figure. Then, of course, you have to go back and you have to finish the, you know, sandblast it and grind it and smooth it and, you know, work on it a little bit. But one of the things I do is once the the piece is done in wax, I'll usually go and spend a few hours working on the wax. So each piece is a little bit different. You know, there are things that I see that I wish I had done differently. So at that point in time, I can make those improvements in the wax.
Let's say you're using bronze for a sculpture. How many bronze sculptures can you get out of one mold? Do you have to do the whole part of the process over again?
Yeah. In other words, you have to fill the mold up with wax and then dip it in the slurry. You have to do that from that point on. Once you have the mold, which is the first step, you can use the mold, the rubber mold, over and over. Mm. I only do 9 because I don't, you know, I think I'd rather not have a lot of pieces around. A lot depends on what it is. If I was going to do some more less serious, well, not that my pieces are serious, but less serious kinds of pieces, I probably would, you know, you can do 100 or you can do 500 or you can do however many you want. Mm-hmm. But I just do 9 of each one.
I think what a lot of people don't realize is what, you know, the work just begins once the bronze comes out of the mold. You know, there's so much finish work involved in a sculpture. And that's when I'm out in, say, the antique world and I pick up a piece of sculpture, a lot of times I really look at the detail of, first of all, the casting and then, you know, what kind of work was done. You know, as far as the burnishing and buffing and all that. And
yeah, the patina is one of the really most important elements because that's what you see. It's so interesting. There are so many different patinas that you can work with and you can experiment. And one of the pieces I have looks kind of like it's stone, you know. I mean, most people think it's stone until I tell them to whack it, and it's actually bronze.
Well, you know, a lot of people, the mistake a lot of people make out there and that own any piece of bronze, you know, bronze sculpture, is that they take metal polish. They polish the patina right off of it. And,
a bad idea.
Yeah, it's a bad idea. It destroys the value of, let's say, an antique. Right away, it'll bring a third of what it's worth, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. Well, one of the advantages of bronze is you can put it anywhere. I mean, you know, it can stay outside. And depending on the patina, but if a piece is going to be outside, usually I'll use a sort of a blackened bronze and then a kind of a greenish
verde
look on it. And that's what happens naturally. If you just leave a piece outside, if you didn't do anything to it and left it outside, that would be the way it would end up in 10 or 15 years. So you can leave that stuff out, and it just gets better and better every year.
Right. I love it. Yeah. Well, Tony, this has been absolutely great.
Well, I appreciate you asking me.
Yes. And so to find Tony's work, it's TonyDowSculpture.com. Thanks again, Tony.
Thank you.
So this is Martin Willis with Tony Dow, and we're signing off.